Contributors to Wisconsin Public Radio include attorney Paul A. Sturgill, serving the legal needs of the elderly and their families throughout Wisconsin and Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Toll-free information is at 888-613-0600.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, providing Employee Benefits Administration, Integrated Health Management, and Pharmacy Benefits Administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.
County Theater in Wausau. This is the Wisconsin Public Radio Route 51 broadcast debate between the candidates for Circuit Court Judge in Marathon County, District Attorney Jill Falstead and Criminal Defense Attorney Peter Rotter. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tonight's debate is co-sponsored by the Wisconsin Institute of Public Policy and Service and is being broadcast on the Ideas Network stations WLBL 91.9 FM Wausau and 930 AM Auburndale Stevens Point, WHBM 90.3 FM Park Falls, and WHRM 90.9 FM Wausau High Definition Channel 3. A special thanks this evening to Dean Sandy Smith in UW Marathon County for making the theater available, and to Chris Burke for providing our technical support. Thanks also to Station Manager Rick Ryer, News Director Michael Leland, Institute Director Eric Giordano, and our production assistants Jane Ritger and Kelson Quisler. The debate will have 90-second opening statements from the candidates and one-minute closing statements. Our panel members will pose individual questions to the candidates, who will each have 1 minute to respond, followed by an open discussion period that will last about 3 minutes. Panel members may offer follow-up questions during those discussion periods. And we have a great panel tonight providing expertise in Marathon County court procedures and case precedents in the criminal justice system and also in drug and alcohol addiction issues. Jeff Stark is the court reporter for the Wausau Daily Herald. He provides observation and analysis of criminal case testimony and court procedures on a daily basis. Dr. Ron Connolly is an instructor facilitator with North Central Technical College's Criminal Justice Program. He spent 10 years with the Milwaukee Police Department and 9 years with the Appleton Police Department, working on gang crime, narcotics enforcement, and uniform patrol. Sue Nowak is an alcohol and drug certified prevention specialist for Premier Recovery Services in Wausau. She is a 33-year employee with North Central Healthcare and co-chair of Bravo, an organization that educates teens and adults on alcohol and drug abuse issues. A round of applause for our panel, please. And now our candidates. Jill Falstead was first elected District Attorney of Marathon County in 1994. She has been reelected 8 times since. She previously served as an assistant DA in Marathon, Portage, and Wood counties. She serves on numerous regional committees on criminal justice issues and has been the recipient of the E. Michael McMahon Prosecutor of the Year Award, the Women's Community Award for Outstanding Achievement in Supporting Sexual Assault Victims, and the YWCA Women of Vision Award. A round of applause, please, for Jill Falstead. And Peter Rotter has spent 7 years as a staff attorney for Wisconsin Judicare with a background that includes private practice, civil law, criminal defense, family law, personal injury, real estate, and contract law. He is also president of the Marathon County Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, the immediate past president of the Marathon County Bar Association, and a board member for Head Start. His work includes outreach to the elderly, the Hmong community, and the economically disadvantaged. A round of applause, please, for Peter Rotter. And now that you've got the clapping out of your system, we ask that you refrain from it until the end of the debate and focus your quiet attention on the questions, the candidates, and their answers. By a flip of the coin, Peter Rotter will go first with the opening and closing statements. Jill Falstead will go second. And Peter, you have 90 seconds.
Thank you, Glenn. Glenn, as you indicated, some of my background. I did graduate from Marquette University Law School in 1988. There I participated in the legal clinic for the elderly. My first job out of law school was at Wisconsin Judicare, and there I handled a wide variety of civil legal matters, including disability benefits, public housing, school discipline, special education, immigration-related matters, as well as administrative duties and training of other attorneys. I worked for a while in the financial products and insurance field and have been in private practice since 1997, handling an even wider array of civil matters, including the work I did at Judicare, as well as family law, personal injuries, contracts, wills, guardian ad litem work, and criminal law. As you indicated, I have been actively involved in our community at large, as well as our legal community, having served in our Marathon County Bar Association and helping to found our criminal defense lawyers group. I have a passion for justice. On their day in court, people need a judge who is fair and will hear all sides of the issues. Judges work hard, I expect to work hard, and I've demonstrated a desire and ability to do so. Let me take a moment, though, to tell you something about my opponent. She has said over and over again that she is already like a judge, judging cases. She is not a judge. She is the prosecutor for the state in an adversarial system. If she is confused about her role as a prosecutor, that's sad. If she were confused about her role as a judge, that would be dangerous. If she's going to try and fool you as a candidate, that's wrong.
Time's up. Jill Falstead, you have 90 seconds.
Thank you. When I first became district attorney back in 1994, one of the first cases I was given was a medically complex homicide case involving a little girl suffering from Cornelia de Lange syndrome. Now, I had never heard of that. The referral was for prosecution on shaken baby syndrome, and quite frankly, I'd never heard of that. How I approached the case was to educate myself on the science involved, the medical science involved, the law involved, and I spent hours reading learned treatises, and eventually what happened was there was a four-week jury trial. We called 40 medical experts and got justice for that little girl who was killed. The perpetrator was held accountable and is still in prison. What that case taught me is that when you're facing a complex trial, and since then, I don't know what it is about Marathon County, but there's been challenging case one after the next, from the Emerson trial where we dealt with mitochondrial DNA for the first time to the recent Prayer case, is that when you are serving as a judge, you need to have the legal skills that I have demonstrated over all these years to analyze complex issues, to research the law, and to make sound and reasonable decisions on how to proceed. I have never shied away from taking on the toughest of cases and making the toughest of decisions, and you can be assured, based on my record, that I will do the same as the next Marathon County judge.
The first question goes to Jeff Stark of the Wausau Daily Herald. Jeff.
Good afternoon. Given your public images as advocates, Jill with your vigorous prosecution in domestic violence cases, and Peter as a defense attorney who has represented the indigent, the people who claim to be wrongfully accused, among many others, how can the public be sure that they can have a fair trial with either of you as a judge?
And we'll go first to Jill and then to Peter. Jill, you have 60 seconds.
Thank you so much. While serving as district attorney, case law has made clear that the DA is more than just an advocate. The district attorney, by case law, is described as a quasi-judicial officer, most analogous doing work, most analogous to the courts. And so I think that
I have always had a big picture of what is justice. If you look at my entire record, I have considered the interests of the public, the interests of victims and their families, and the interest of offenders and their families in deciding how to proceed, what to recommend to courts as sentencing. I have always focused on meaningful treatment and rehabilitation, and I think that overall fair and balanced approach can assure the public that anybody who comes before me when I am judge will be treated with dignity, respect, and will have a fair and open-minded judge deciding their case.
Peter, you have 60 seconds.
Thank you. As attorneys, we are trained to look at the law and to be able to apply that law to the facts as they are developed. As attorneys, when we are trained, we don't know which side we're going to be on. And in private practice, we don't know who's going to hire us. Is it going to be a plaintiff or is it going to be a defendant? Is it going to be a petitioner or is it going to be a respondent? In private practice, I have had the opportunity to represent people on both sides of many different issues. And I've never had trouble being able to advocate for a client regardless of which side of an issue they are on, because I do have that ability to analyze the facts and apply the law to them. I can certainly do that as a judge. I've experience of having to be on both sides of different types of issues, and I'm sure that therefore as a judge I will be able to be fair after having heard the facts and applying the law to those facts.
Jeff, do you have a follow-up?
Yes. What are your thoughts on having a diversity in the Marathon County Courthouse as a whole, looking at backgrounds, whether they're defense attorneys or prosecutors or people who specialize in civil law or any other? Why is it important to perhaps have a mix of interests and backgrounds?
And we've got about 3 minutes, whichever one of you wants to start first.
I guess if I understand your question, you're saying what diversity do we bring to the bench if we were to be the next judge?
Yes.
I think obviously what I would offer as far as diversity goes is gender balance to the courts. I believe there has been a female judge serving at least for the last quarter century, and I believe it's important to have diversity in all positions, including the position of judge. I think it's important for elected officials to be diverse, and I think I can offer that to the bench in Marathon County.
Jeff, I think there are many different forms of diversity. One example of that is, as my opponent has suggested, gender diversity. There's also racial diversity. There's also religious diversity. There are all kinds of different forms of diversity that we see in the general public. Within the law, there's another type of diversity, and that's diversity between different areas of practice. Currently on our bench, we've got two former prosecutors from our Marathon County District Attorney's Office out of our current four judges, out of the total five that we'll have. If we were to have another prosecutor from the Marathon County District Attorney's Office, I think that creates an imbalance. I think that the form of diversity we're talking about amongst judges on the bench would be diversity amongst frames of reference in terms of practice of law and the diversity that they can bring from that experience. And that's something that I think I bring, and that's critically important at this time.
And if you look at what happens throughout the state and certainly throughout the nation, many, many district attorneys go on to become judges, and they are excellent judges. And I think if you look at the prosecutors and DAs that have gone on to become judges in Marathon County, I think they have excelled as judges. It's a very good training ground. You spend years making decisions that are subject to public scrutiny, and that is the same thing judges do, and that's why I think you see that trend throughout the whole country with DAs going on to become judges, because it is such a good training ground, and you end up with excellent judges, and again, that's what I would bring to the bench.
But what about the implication that with two former prosecutors on the bench already, it's going to be hard for defendants to get a fair shake if we have three now?
And I would be surprised if there is a defendant that thinks that either of the former two prosecutors who are now judges have been unfair. I think they have been very fair and balanced and neutral in their administration of justice for Marathon County.
Well, I would beg to differ with my opponent's recent statement that it would be hard to find a defendant who thought they were not handled fairly. Frankly, I've spoken with criminal defendants, and they have had some concerns. And there are criminal defendants who have a right of substitution. That's something that, as a criminal defendant, remains. And currently, if they substitute, there's a potential they'll have another former Marathon County prosecutor as their judge. If there is another former Marathon County prosecutor on the bench, that becomes a likelihood. And we have to be aware of something called the appearance of impropriety. That is as important as the impartiality directly, is to make sure that we also maintain that when people look at our system, it looks fair, so that they feel, well, if I have to go there, I'll get a fair shake. And I think that is something that we have to be concerned about. I also want to comment on whether the district attorney's office is such a great training ground, and that's why we have former prosecutors on the bench, versus whether that is a great way to get your name in front of the public and develop name recognition that gets you votes regardless of ability.
Jill, we'll give you 15 seconds, and we've got to move on.
Thank you. If you look at the balance of the court, really a huge segment of what the courts do is focus on criminal matters. Right now, there's two judges with background in civil law. Previously, there were three. Right now, there's two who have a background, substantial background in criminal law. Because so much of the court's time is spent on criminal law, I think it's very important to have a judge with a strong background in that area, and that's what I would offer. Whether it's three versus two or three, one way or the other, I think I have a very high level of experience and knowledge to offer the bench.
Let's move on to Ron Connolly for the second question. Ron?
Peter and Jill, if you would comment on how your decision making will be affected by the current economic climate. And when I say decision making in this economic climate, it's specifically addressing things such as jail overcrowding, probation and parole case overload, special programs for victims and families, things of that nature.
And we'll start with Peter. You've got 60 seconds, and then Jill.
Thank you, Glenn and Ron. Frankly, the question you've asked tends to focus fairly heavily on the criminal justice system. Judges, of course, have to deal with far more than criminal justice. There are a wide variety of civil areas that I think are going to be heavily impacted by our current economic circumstances. I think we're going to be seeing far more foreclosures. There are going to be more eviction actions, replevin actions, contract disputes, and things of that sort. With regard to the criminal justice system, this is still a critical issue. We are on the verge of building a $40 million jail that is going to cost $4 million a year to run, with projections we'll likely be building another jail or addition in 10 years. I don't think we can afford that, and I don't think that's good for our people, for our community, for our society. I think we need to be focusing on treatment, because no matter what we do, the vast majority of people we send to jail or prison are coming out, and if we don't make them better, we're just going to be in the same circumstances we were in before we sent them there, just dollars shorter.
Jill, you've got 60 seconds.
Well, first of all, I don't think that anyone believes we're going to be spending $40 million right now to build a jail in these economic times. The meetings I have been to, we are not having a choice, either $40 million jail or working on alternatives. What we've made a commitment to do is to continue to work on the alternatives, of which Marathon County has been a leader in developing alternatives to incarceration and alternative treatment programs. And we've all made a commitment to continue our work in that. On the other hand, we are looking at other ways to add capacity, whether we continue to transport prisoners or build some other type of Huber facility or start a phase-in project. That's up to the county board, and that's up to the citizens of Marathon County to decide how to proceed. And I plan to be fully involved in those discussions, and those are important issues our community needs to decide.
Ron, do you have a follow-up?
Yes, thank you. What I'm hearing is you're both acknowledging the fact that building prisons, or jails rather, is an expensive venture. You both are acknowledging that we are in difficult economic times. And Peter, I heard you mention emphasis on treatment, and Jill, you mentioned continuing to work on alternatives. Can you address anyone who may have concerns that victims would be deprived of justice by allowing some people who would seemingly perhaps deserve to be sent to jail actually be diverted into a treatment facility or into some sort of alternative rather than being sent to jail when it would appear that that's what's warranted?
And we'll open it up for a discussion.
Okay. Thank you.
I'd be happy to address that. Our office recently has initiated and developed two alternative programs, and in setting up, developing, and implementing those programs, we have been very, very careful to honor victims' rights. We have a strong record of honoring victims' rights, and certainly as a judge, I will be very sensitive to the interests and concerns of victims and recognize that the impact of the crime on the victim is always of utmost importance. But we have set up what's called a diversion program, and before we divert cases, if there is a victim involved, we talk to them about what that will mean, what the outcome may involve, and again, we if we're going to take those cases out of the formal court process, and this is for low-level, youthful, and first-time offenders, we will consult with the victims to see that they agree with that, the focus being on rehabilitation and treatment of those offenders so that they learn to make better choices, non-criminal choices. Another very important initiative that we've undertaken, implemented, and developed is the Adult Restorative Justice Program, and that actually pulls the victim into the community conferencing process where the victim has an opportunity to have a face-to-face meeting with the offender. And again, before a victim is brought into that process, we spend time discussing that process with them, preparing them for that meeting, preparing the offender to make sure that's a meaningful process for both. And again, if an offender agrees to that, to focus on treatment and changing their poor decision-making, then they receive reduced consequences, which again means less use of probation and valuable jail resources.
Peter,
and yet
you need to jump in here.
Sure.
Thank you. I'm trying to be polite, and I thought there would be some limit to that. I think that it is important to keep in mind the needs and the rights of victims. I'm a little troubled with the term of a defendant or an offender who deserves prison. I think that we need to keep in mind, for one thing, that there are many crimes for which there is not a direct victim, and that many of those crimes are the ones that are most amenable to treatment, that there are crimes driven by substance abuse and by mental illness, and that we need to be attending to those needs and looking for ways to improve those people, to rehabilitate them and treat them, and those are of utmost importance. With regard to the needs of victims, there are statutes regarding victims' rights, and victims have a right to input into a case. As an attorney who has represented offenders, I've often been in contact with the victims of the crimes who want nothing more than for those people to receive some treatment, or sometimes just outright want that case dropped. And we sometimes run into an absolute stonewall in terms of getting those cases dropped under those circumstances. So needs of victims are important, but apparently, and I think appropriately, they are not the end all. We certainly don't want to have our justice system devolve into a system of blood feuds and revenge.
Joe, Peter seems to be criticizing the way you're handling the district attorney's office. You're not dropping cases that maybe should be dropped or funneling them in the right direction.
Sure. I can assure everybody that when we make our charging decisions in the DA's office, we do it on a case-by-case basis. We consider the facts and evidence and reports sent to us by law enforcement who have investigated these matters because victims and citizens have called for law enforcement assistance. And then we look at the information in the file. We consider the person's criminal history, if there is one, and we make very thoughtful and careful decisions. As far as the low-level drug offenders, I can tell people that in the last 2 years, 2.5 years since we've had our diversion program in place, we have focused on, as I said, youthful low-level offenders, which include low-level drug offenders, and we've sent approximately 100 of those cases each year into our diversion program, which has focused on holding that case open so that the person has an opportunity for education and treatment and addressing their drug needs, and if they comply with treatment, they can avoid a criminal record. I think that's a very fair and balanced approach to dealing with that type of crime.
We're going to get into this whole section of criminal law next, but first, for those of you who just tuned in, you are listening to the Route 51 broadcast debate of the candidates for Marathon County Judge, Jill Falstead and Peter Rotter, live from the UW Marathon County Theater in Wausau, and also on the Ideas Network stations of Wisconsin Public Radio. Sue Nowak, you have the next question.
Okay. Jill and Peter, my question is, what is your understanding of addiction and how it plays into the criminal cases that you deal with?
And Jill, you go first. You have 60 seconds, then Peter.
Well, I think there's several ways to look at addiction. Certainly I've read literature on the medical basis of it. I realize it can be very difficult and challenging for people to long-term overcome the issues that addiction present in their life. I think with that in mind, I've been very supportive of programming that not only has the treatment component, if it's appropriate, but has that aftercare component that can also incorporate relapse prevention strategies and individual counseling if that is appropriate. One example of that, and I don't know if I'm taking a am I at my minute yet? Okay.
Have we flashed the red card?
One example is we have focused on a driving with care program for OWI fourth offenders, and I think that has been a very innovative program set up in Marathon County. Other counties look at what we've
We'll have time to continue. Peter, your understanding of addiction and the role it plays in criminal cases.
Thank you, Glenn and Sue. First, I want to say that my understanding of addiction is that addiction is best defined as a disease. And I know people who have been addicted to substances, whether it be alcohol or other drugs. And my experience with them, and in particular my experience with people who are in recovery, it makes it absolutely clear that this is a disease, and it is a devastating disease. And this doesn't excuse anybody's behavior. We have to recognize that. But boy, we found a cure for polio, and we should be putting our efforts into finding cures for the substance abuse issues that we have in our society. Now, that takes us outside of the justice realm, but it's critically important to be aware of that. Within our criminal justice realm, I see that we do have some programs in place. We really need to expand them. It is a crisis situation such as we have now with the need to build a new jail that may well be the catalyst we need to develop those programs further.
And Sue Nowak, do you have a follow-up?
Well, just wanting to get a better view of, or a better understanding of your view of how mental health issues tie in with addiction.
Well, I have to say, quite frankly, we see a lot of overlap in that area, and it is an area I think the system struggles with. You know, I can give you an example. A couple weeks ago, we had a meeting, and I think our approach to it has been to meet with the people involved in dealing with that individual and really sit down and talk about what is a plan, how can we approach providing care and treatment for this person, because you have to look at every case by case with that individual's particular needs and diagnosis and issues. And we had a fellow who kept coming into the court system and was found not competent. Well, then we meet with the care providers and people working with them, and we talk about addiction issues, we talk about mental health issues, and we put together a plan of how we could work in and provide treatment and structure through the criminal system, but also understand his needs, which could also be coordinated with his treatment providers in the home he was situated in. So I think it really takes a team approach. It takes that extra time and effort to understand what that individual, what the mix of addiction and diagnosis is for that person, and try to work with people in the system providing care to come up with the best plan.
Glenn and Sue, again, thank you. I think these are very insightful questions. Mental illness and substance abuse often go hand in hand. I know in my experience we so often see dual diagnosis, and it comes up particularly where we see repeat offenders, and we have addressed issues such as substance abuse without addressing underlying issues of mental health. And you really can't fix one without fixing them both. If you fix just one, sooner or later the other one is going to get the best of the person. So if you've addressed substance abuse issues and there are still mental illness issues there, sooner or later self-medication occurs, or simple poor judgment and bad practices will arise again. What's critically important is not just that on an individual basis we look at this person and say, well, okay, so you need some treatment. We really need far more extensive treatment programs in our community. I think that is an area where we are extremely lacking. We don't have the variety of programs that they have in many other states. I believe Minnesota, to our west, has far more mental health and substance abuse programs than we have here in Wisconsin. And they also happen to have a much smaller percentage of people incarcerated. And I think that that's not mere coincidence. I think that there is a direct cause and effect. If we can correct people's behavior, if we can correct their substance abuse and mental illness issues, then we shouldn't have to have them in our jail. And I think in the end, that pays dividends.
We're going to have to move on for time constraints, but we'll be getting back into this general area of discussion later. The next question goes to Jeff Stark of the Wausau Daily Herald. Jeff?
Over the past few years, I've heard several comments from both prosecutors and defense attorneys about the truth in sentencing formula, that they kind of laugh at it at times. And I wanted to get your thoughts on if you believe that the current formula does work, and if you think it does, why does it? And if it doesn't, what would be your suggestions for altering that?
And, Peter, you go first. You've got 60 seconds.
Thank you, Glenn. And, Jeff, again, I think that's a wonderful question. I have been frustrated by the truth in sentencing law, and I'm particularly frustrated just in the name we give it. That it implies that what we had before somehow was not truth in sentencing. But what we were doing before, the system of parole, early release, and mandatory release, was as truthful as anything we have now. All of the conditions were listed in the statutes. All anybody needed to get the truth of that was to look at the statutes. What that provided for was the potential that a person had been sent to prison would be able to earn their release early, after a quarter of the sentence had been completed, upon demonstrating they had achieved the goals that we wanted them to achieve. And that was evaluated by a team of experts. We've completely removed that team of experts. Now a judge is expected to be able to anticipate what's going on 5 or 10 or even 30 years down the road.
Jill, you've got 60 seconds.
Well, back when we had the old system, there were a lot of complaints about how people were paroled out and when they were paroled out and if those decisions were made fairly. So the thought was if we had truth in sentencing, it would give the courts an ability to structure a sentence that at least gave the public and victims a certainty about how long the person would be incarcerated and how long they would be on extended supervision. Over time, though, programming options have been developed to allow persons options to earn their way out, and then there have been laws added that allow for sentence petition for adjustments of the sentence, whether it depends on what level of crime you're at, whether at 75% or 85%. So the whole concept of truth in sentencing really has been eroded. It has been difficult to follow. And my assumption is, based on the discussions and the proposals by the governor, is that we may well be going back to the old system.
We're going to open this up for just 90 seconds because we're running a little bit over on time. If either of you have anything to add, and again, during these discussion periods, you are free to question each other and talk directly to each other as candidates if that's something you feel would be fruitful.
Thank you, Glenn. I would like to say that the old system had as much certainty built into it as this current system does with regard to how long a person would be incarcerated. And the example I use, because I can do the math easily, is if a judge sentenced a person to 10 years, there was certainty. The person would have to serve one quarter of the sentence, 2.5 years. There was nothing uncertain about that. Everybody knew it because it was printed in the statutes. The judges certainly knew it. Nobody was fooling a judge. They were never confused about how long the person was going to have to sit. That's often why they sentenced 10 years, so the guy would sit at least 2.5. But it was also understood the person would get out at two-thirds of the sentence, mandatory, because they wanted the person out with some continuation of supervision. And that is something so important, we continue it even now in truth in sentencing. The judge sentences a person to 10 years, but then says you'll serve 5 in and then 5 extended supervision. Well, it's all we've done is taken out the parole board, that team of experts that can make an assessment of the individual, say, okay, at 2.5 years, you achieved your goals. You can get out early. Versus at 5 years, hey, wait a minute, you're still dangerous, and you're staying. And that's gone now. I think that it was a mistake to have done that, and I think we're paying for it now with longer prison sentences and
exploding prison and jail populations.
Jill, very
again, I think truth in sentencing really was put in effect with the hope of providing victims and the community with greater certainty of when a court said this number or gave this sentence, that they would at least have that peace of mind to know that during that period of time they would be safe or, and that the person wouldn't be released. But what has happened over time is when you talk to the victim or the community about the sentence, you say, well, they can still get out at this point or they may be eligible for this type of release program. And it hasn't provided the certainty, I think, that anybody was hoping to provide to victims in the community. So the old system really had as much value in that regard as the current truth in sentencing.
Okay, if we're going to move on to Ron Connolly. Ron, your next question, please.
Okay, Peter and Jill, history has shown, at least at the Supreme Court level, and I believe there's a trickle-down, that there's a contrast in political viewpoints, with liberals generally oriented toward individual rights, conservatives more focused on public order. Where do your priorities fall, and how will you balance public order concerns with preservation of individual rights?
Jill, you've got 60 seconds.
Thank you. I think it is critically important for judges to have a balanced view of the law. And I intend to have a fair and balanced view in making my decisions. For example, I will not hesitate to keep the community safe. I think that's an important consideration when sentencing heinous and dangerous high-end criminals. But on the other hand, I am also very aware of how important it can be to rehabilitate offenders and focus on meaningful treatment so that individuals don't continue to make choices that are criminal, that are wrong, that victimize more victims. I mean, if you have people engage in meaningful, genuine treatment that can address that behavior, then that really translates into safer communities, safer families, and that's a very important consideration. So, again, I will look at the impact of the crime on victims, consider treatment options for offenders, but also keep in mind the need to protect the public.
Peter, you have 60 seconds.
Thank you. Somebody much wiser than I once said, lawlessness begets lawlessness. That is why it's so important for the state to obey its own laws. I think that is a statement that reflects the importance of individual rights. Individual rights are not somehow divorced from protecting the community. That is also protection of the community. And it is by upholding the Constitution that individual rights are protected. And it is by upholding the Constitution that our community is protected. And I don't think that is something that is somehow going to divide upon liberal versus conservative or partisan lines. That's just simply the way our system is designed. We do have law enforcement officers who, if they do their jobs correctly, will protect us on an individual basis. It is our Constitution and the defenders of the Constitution that will protect our society and community as a whole.
Ron, do you have a follow-up?
I guess what I'd like to ask in light of Peter's comments are, with specific regard to there is no partisanship when it comes to individual rights versus public order, and it's based in the Constitution, we've seen, as I mentioned before, at the Supreme Court level, we've seen during the Warren administration or the Warren Court that there were many, many individual rights decisions that were generated by that court. Over time and through the Berger Court, we saw a movement away from that and perhaps a movement more towards center. Now with the Rehnquist Court and certainly the Roberts Court, we're seeing more public order decisions being made. We're seeing public order come to the forefront in terms of how we approach security at airports, the Patriot Act, things like that. So clearly, I mean, history has shown that despite the Constitution, we still do have somewhat of a partisan division in terms of viewpoints regarding individual rights or public order. And so I guess what I'm asking our two candidates here is, how is that going to affect your decision-making? And where do you fall in line Are you both saying that you're falling right down the center? Where are your priorities?
I don't think that question can be answered. Am I jumping in too soon?
Go ahead.
Okay. I don't think that question can be answered along the liberal versus conservative or partisan lines, and I think that is the straightest answer I can give you. This is a constitutional issue. It is my obligation as judge to follow the Constitution and administer the laws of the state of Wisconsin, and I intend to do that to the very best of my ability. And that's really where the tough decisions for a judge comes down. And, you know, one of the most famous cases that everybody is familiar with is the Miranda case. It's a very tough decision for judges. Do you exclude evidence that you know shows the guilt of the individual because it was obtained illegally? And that's really a tough decision to make. But if that's what the law is, then especially as a trial court judge, we don't have any choice. It's not as though a trial court judge is somehow going to make some new law. There's simply no way for that to occur. So we have to apply the law as it is written. And if we don't, or if we do it wrong, the Court of Appeals is going to overturn us, or the Supreme Court's going to overturn us.
Well, Jill, as a judge, would you apply the Miranda case and throw something out of court?
I absolutely would. And, in fact, that type of decision cannot be made on liberal versus conservative or any sort of a partisan line. I will not hesitate to suppress evidence that has been illegally obtained. And, in fact, in assessing cases that have come across my desk in very significant prosecutions, when I look at even recorded interviews or assess how evidence was obtained, if it was not done properly or by the book or legally, I have oftentimes gone in and stipulated that should be suppressed. I want to maintain my credibility with the courts. I'm not going to misrepresent anything to the courts, and I know the decision the courts need to make. And that is, we need to follow the law. I've done that as DA, and I would do that as judge.
I'm going to ask you both a very simple, but some would say a loaded question. What do you think of the American Civil Liberties Union?
I have to say I do respect a lot of the work they do. I think they take on some very difficult issues, unpopular issues, and I think they've done very important work.
The American Civil Liberties Union has, you know, I have a lot of respect for them as well. Not everything they do is work that I agree with, but I suppose that would be true of everyone and everything I could ever evaluate. Over the years, I think they have moved out of their original role of defenders of the Constitution into a more liberal role that is interfering in rights more than it is protecting them. And that's unfortunate because they were, I think, an organization that could have done much more good, and they have lost some of their power as a result of their shift.
Interesting response. I'm Glenn Moberg. You're listening to the Route 51 broadcast debate of the candidates for Marathon County Judge, Jill Falstead and Peter Rotter, live from the UW Marathon County Theater in Wausau on the Ideas Network stations of Wisconsin Public Radio. And we turn to Sue Nowak of Premier Recovery Services for the next question.
How do you feel about the first OWI being a felony, and what are your thoughts about what the OWI laws should be in Wisconsin?
And let me check here. Peter, you're going to go first on this.
Let me ask, though, do you mean felony or do you just mean making it criminal?
Wisconsin has the most lenient laws of all of the states. So, you know, again, there's a lot of talk about what our OWI laws should be.
All right. The discussion goes in a couple of different directions. One is, do we make our first offense, OWI, criminal, which can be done merely by making it a misdemeanor? And there has been some suggestion that we make our first offense a felony, which is a far more serious crime. Let me say that I think one of the things that's been going on is this talk about lenient laws for OWI, and I think that does us all a disservice. If we made first offense OWI a felony but continued to talk about it as though we were treating it very leniently, I don't think we will have done any good. Everybody out there is going to think, hey, it's real lenient, and I'll just have another beer and drive home, and they won't know any better until they get arrested and find out all the trouble they're in. Our laws are actually very effective. OWI recidivism rates are actually lower than for many other crimes. There are lots of things we can do better. And I can talk more about that maybe in the discussion section.
Julie, you've got 60 seconds.
Well, obviously, there are so many proposals floating around right now. It's hard to sort through them, and I recognize that that's a task for the legislature to figure out. But one of the things that I think would be very, very helpful to do would be to make probation available on the second offense OWI. Right now, we cannot even get probation until the fourth offense OWI, and at that, we can get 1 year probation. Right now in Marathon County, I mentioned this earlier, we have a driving with care program that is a 33-session program. It's very intensive. It lasts about 4 months for the first treatment portion of it, but then it requires really for long-term success 1 year after care. Well, what happens now is we hope that people will voluntarily proceed after their year of probation is up and conclude that. But what we have found is that program is proven successful in reducing repeat drunk driving. Why are we waiting to do that on the fourth offense? If we could have that imposed on the second offense and stop the third, fourth, and fifth, with a program we know has shown success, then that would be a great plus for the community and for the offenders to get the treatment they need.
Sue, do you have a follow-up?
I do. Working with a lot of teens that get underage drinking charges, I just want to know what your thoughts are on the underage drinking penalties. Are they stiff enough? What would you like to see for the underage drinking?
If I might answer that, I think that when we see teens already involved in alcohol to the extent that they are receiving citations for underage drinking, I think that the most critical thing we can do is direct them into treatment programs and make that a condition for them. One of the ways that that can be done is through a deferred entry of judgment in the underage drinking citation and make that a condition of obtaining your deferral. Beyond that, some of the penalties that the teens get hit with are actually fairly severe. They lose their driver's license, and for anybody who's been the parent of a teenager, you know just how hard that hits. Other things that we try and do tend to be difficult. If we increase fines, especially for those who are under the age of 18, those fines tend to come out of mom and dad's pockets, so we're penalizing mom and dad. Perhaps that's good. But we need to be looking at this a little more, understanding it to be a complex problem and addressing it with intelligent and creative solutions rather than the knee-jerk solutions of let's get tougher, because tougher doesn't always make it better. It just makes it more expensive.
I think with younger people, underage alcohol is and can be a red flag of larger problems going on in that individual's life. So I think assessment is critical, determining what the issues are, whether they're education or treatment issues that need to be addressed for that person. And when I say that often is a red flag to something more significant going on, I think it brings up an important program that has been instituted in Marathon County, and that is our truancy court. And that is a program that was instituted by Judge Grau, and where he puts the truants right on supervision to the court. And what happens in the truancy cases is one of the first assessments done almost immediately after they appear in court is a screening for AODA issues, a screening and assessment. And if there are issues there, those truant underage people are sent into family counseling services programming right away. The court then stays on top of monitoring how that juvenile is doing, not only on schooling issues, but on AODA issues, on attending school. Other supervision and services are offered, and I think it's looking at that piece, but also the larger piece as being part of the best response we can offer our underage people.
Any of our panelists have a follow-up you'd like to venture on this particular issue? Sue, do you have any other thoughts?
Well, and Peter, when we look at the cost, and you say raising the cost, but right now a lot of the teens that I work with are, you know, the cost is nothing to them. They don't care how expensive it's going to get. And oftentimes the teens are saying, well, you know, it's just a slap on the wrist. They're not getting anything out of their first offense, and then they go and get second, third, fourth offense. So not only the first offense, what are your thoughts when they keep getting multiple offenses?
Well, again, part of what you said, I think, is exactly what I had said. If we increase the costs, especially to a teen, teens are often still living with mom and dad, and those costs are not directly borne by themselves. Or if they are, they are imposed upon a teen who is only newly into the world of being financially responsible and doesn't understand the implications of the high costs of some of these tickets. I'm not suggesting that we don't ticket them and that there not be penalties. I only suggest that this is a complex problem best addressed through treatment and through more creative and intelligent responses and investigations into what they're going to need. Again, if the penalties are only going to fall to the parents, maybe that's why the parents don't care.
You indicated before you didn't think there were enough social programs available.
I agree.
Jill, what's your position on that?
Enough social programs.
For treatment for people who have addiction, drug and alcohol problems.
You know, I have to say there still are a lot of needs, but I think we have made tremendous progress in Marathon County with coming up with alternatives, coming up with meaningful programming. And one of the things, I guess, to tie in with the issue you've raised about underage alcohol is we have set up, as I said earlier, a diversion program for youthful offenders, low-level offenders, first-time offenders. And one of the things we look at when we're assessing that individual is to look at whether or not they have had underage alcohol violations, because that is a red flag. It is something that we can look at to incorporate into the programming that we ask of that individual through the case that we're diverting from the formal court system. But through that case, we're focusing on the larger picture for that individual, for that young person. We're looking at AODA issues, and part of that is that underage alcohol history. Yes, it's there, and it's something we can work on through our programming in the diversion court process we've set up.
Ron?
Very quickly, with regard to underage drinking and consumption of alcohol, do either of you have plans to incorporate the parents in any of your court decisions as far as getting actively involved with their child who has committed such violations?
The problem with doing that is, with the age of majority being 18, sometimes that's simply not possible. So underage drinking citations are still issued to people between the ages of 18 and 21, and it's impossible to impose a condition that they work with their parents, or it's impossible for us to work with the parents directly. When they're under the age of 18, there is some ability to do that, and I think that that does need to be expanded to the extent that the teens can be brought to work better with their parents. Having been the father of six teens all at one time for a little while, I understand just how much tension there can be between a teen and his or her parent, and how difficult it can be to get them all to work together. And sometimes that's not going to be effective. Sometimes it will. And there are programs out there that either are already in existence or that can be developed that can address those needs. And we need to have those kinds of programs to direct the kids and their parents into.
What do the two of you think about marijuana laws? Do you think they're too lenient, too strict?
They're the law, so we have to apply them and follow them. We don't get to pick and choose which laws we like and which laws we don't. They're all just simply the law.
Would you, as a judge, have some discretion in the sentencing that you would give first, second offenders, and so on?
Well, judges have some discretion in sentencing. I guess what's interesting is that in cases such as simple possession of controlled substances, misdemeanor cases, generally those are handled by an assistant district attorney, and then they're handled by a defense attorney, and sometimes just the individual, him or herself, pro se, by themselves. And an agreement is reached between them as to what the sentence is going to be, and then that's presented to the judge by people who know far more about the circumstances than the judge will have an opportunity to learn. And so right now, first offenses are dealt with in a variety of different ways. And in my experience, there are treatment options offered and deferred entries of judgment offered. Our statutes even have programs for deferred entry of judgment. And in Marathon County, that's often used. But if those options aren't offered to the judge, sometimes the judge has simply no authority to order it without an agreement.
And I do think those laws are appropriate. There are many options we can look at in dealing with someone charged with possession of marijuana. We do utilize what I've called, again, our diversion program, which diverts those from the formal court process if it's someone who's in possession of a pot, pipe, or pot. And then we have a very good route that we take them on our diversion program. As I said, we've diverted over 200 such cases in the last two-plus years. We have been very attentive in making sure there's random drug and alcohol testing done, that there is good programming and treatment provided to them. And then if they address this issue and successfully complete the treatment, they do not have a drug conviction on their record. There also is statutory
we've got to move
allowances.
On. Let me ask one more question. I want like a real quick response from both of you. Do you think elections are an appropriate way to select a person for this or any judgeship?
I say absolutely they are.
I'll talk
more about it.
I agree. We have agreement on something. I think the way to select judges is through elections.
How do you remove the influence of money and politics from elections then?
I think on this level it hasn't been a big issue. I might be wrong, but
I agree
I don't
with
have
that
much.
Also. I don't know that there's a lot of money and influence going into this campaign.
We're going to move on to the closing statements, and again, by a flip of the coin, Peter, you go first, Jill, you go second, and you each have 60 seconds. Peter?
Thank you, Glenn. Actually, your last question leads into my closing statement. We get high turnout for elections for the president and for senators, and there was very low turnout for the primary, for the judicial election. And I think that it's anticipated we'll have low turnout in the general election this April. And I think that's disappointing, and I want to point out that very few people who are listening to this program will have ever had the opportunity to sit down with the president and share intimate details of their life and then have that president make a decision affecting their personal life. And yet that's what judges do every day. And I'm going to bet that almost everybody that's listening to this program knows somebody who has sat down in a room with a judge and had to share the intimate details of their life and then had that judge make a personal decision that's going to affect the rest of their life. And for that reason, I think it's critically important that we elect our judges, and I think it's critically important that you get out and vote and participate.
Jill Falstead, you have 60 seconds.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for this show and the opportunity to answer these questions and address the public here through this experience. I am running for Marathon County Judge because I have served the public as a prosecutor for the past 20 years. I am passionate about justice and being fair and balanced in my approach to treating people, and I have a proven record of serving the public over the last 20 years, certainly as the last 14 years as an elected official. I have approached my decision-making with integrity. I have strong dedication to the work and have put in a tremendous amount of hours for this community. I will continue to do that while serving as the next judge, and I will rely upon my extensive trial experience and experience in making the very, very tough decisions that need to be made on complex and difficult cases. As I've done as DA, I will continue to do if asked to serve as the Marathon County Judge in Branch 1.
Thank you, Jill Falstead and Peter Rotter. A round of applause, please, for our judicial candidates. Also, a big thank you to our panelists, Jeff Stark of the Wausau Daily Herald, Dr. Ron Connolly of North Central Technical College's Criminal Justice Education Program, and Sue Nowak, Certified Prevention Specialist with Premier Recovery Systems. Weren't they great? Thanks also to Dean Sandy Smith and Chris Berg of UW-Marathon County, Eric Giordano of the Wisconsin Institute for Public Policy and Service, which co-sponsored tonight's event, and to Rick Ryer, Michael Leland, Jane Ricker, and Kelson Quisler of Wisconsin Public Radio. This concludes tonight's debate. on Route 51 and here live at the UW Marathon County Theater. I'm Glenn Moberg of Wisconsin Public Radio, reminding you that this has been broadcast regionally on the Ideas Network stations WLVL 91.9 FM Wausau and 930 AM Auburndale Stevens Point, WHBM 90.3 FM Park Falls, and WHRM 90.9 FM Wausau High Definition Channel 3. A big round of applause for all of you for being such a great audience. Don't forget to vote. It's Tuesday, April 7th. Stay involved. Good night, everybody.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from UMR, providing Employee Benefits Administration, Integrated Health Management, and Pharmacy Benefits Administration for self-funded employers throughout the U.S. More about UMR at umr.com.